Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, we have Professor Glenn McGee joining us and author Jay DeLassica. Matt Curtis, my co-host, joins me. I'm Denise Howell. We're going to talk about bioethics in the area of reproductive technologies, all prompted from a discussion of JD's new book, Biohack. We'll look at designer babies, three-parent progeny, longevity gone awry, abandoned DNA, mummies, dodos, mammoths, and more, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Matt Curtis, and Mike Keyes. Episode 426, recorded June 15th, 2018. A sheepish clone. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're very happy that you're joining us for today's episode of This Week in Law, because I've got to say, it's one of the more fascinating ones I've ever prepared for. Huge issues of life and death throughout, so can't tell you how excited I am that we're all here together today to do this show and that you are joining us. The reason that we're all here together today is a good friend of mine, J.D. Lassica, has written a book called Biohack, which I have read at his behest and actually narrated the audio version of at his behest, which we are anxiously awaiting. Hello, J.D. It's great that you're here today.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Denise.
JD is a three-time guest here on This Week in Law. We were discussing that when he hits five times, we might have to give him a blazer a la the SNL tradition. However, if I did that for every five-time guest, I'm sure it would completely break our show budget. So I'm not sure that I can promise it.
But we'd have a lively wardrobe. So
yes, it's great to have you here. JD's book is about developments in genetic and reproductive technology. It's a science fiction near future thriller that has some really interesting issues that it raises. So to help us better understand and get our minds blown by those issues, we also have joining us today Glenn McGee, who is a professor of health policy and management at the University of New Haven School of Health Sciences. Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
It's so great to have you with us.
It's a pleasure. Good stuff.
We're all incredibly jealous of Glenn because we've had a lot of fun getting ready for today's show. And he gets to think about these issues all the time. This is what he does for work. So we're pretty thrilled and in awe that you've been able to craft a career in that area, Glenn. Before the show, you were starting to tell us how that came about. Can you expand on that for our audience?
Well, like most people, I think, who work in the field of bioethics, I came to it somewhat personally. My father was a bioethics professor, one of the very first back in the 1960s, and I was adopted. And so those two things just sort of seemed to have mixed up throughout my life. I worked on ethical issues in reproductive technology and did my PhD in philosophy, but then realized I didn't know anything about the genetics and did a postdoc in the Human Genome Project. And ever since then, those things have just sort of danced around for me. I have spent most of my professional life teaching medical students and nurses and residents and so on, but really writing a long series of studies and articles and books about how people think about what it is to have children and how that's going to change with new technology. So I love JD's book, and I'm really excited you had me.
We're thrilled that you're here. Also here is my co-host, Matt Curtis. Hi, Matt. Great. Glad you could join us today.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on again. And I'm thrilled to hear the audiobook version. Half of the audiobook is always about the narrator. So I'm sure you did a great job, Denise.
Oh, well, thank you so much for that. We're actually going to play a bit of the audio of JD's book. So sort of to set the stage for our discussion today, we're going to start out with issues on the life and birth end of the spectrum. Fanny Doe, one of our former interns, made that bumper for us. That's his daughter, Daenerys. Isn't that just the most perfect?
It's darling. Yes.
Yes. I thought it fit well for our discussion today. All right. So as I said, we are gathered here today, friends, because our good friend JD has written this great book, which I commend to you. And through a convoluted series of emails, inveigled me into doing the audio version of it. We are anxiously awaiting it to go live on the Audible site. The book itself has been on Amazon now for some time. So you should definitely go pick it up on Amazon. And in addition, just for purposes of this show, JD is doing a promotion for those of you listening and watching with us today. If you go to birthrightsunlimited.com/twill, what will you find there, JD?
Well, Denise, you will find a special offer just for Twill guests actually the first 10 people who register and join my new Best of Indie Readers Circle will get a free copy of the book, plus a free bonus, a 36-page color PDF. So it's all in good fun, but you know, we're trying to get some more publicity about the book. We've had it out on Amazon for 3 weeks now. It's gotten over 60 five-star reviews organically, so it's getting a lot of great feedback from readers. But we're just trying to get it into the hands of more people who hopefully, you know, like the book or at least read the book and leave an honest review. That's what we're doing with this giveaway.
Right. And please do, if and when we do ever get the audio up, it's now in the hands of Audible. Yes. Please do the same if you are an audiobook consumer, and I certainly am. Please let us know. This is the first time I've ever narrated an audiobook, so I would love to know what all of you think of that as well once it's available. And to sort of give you a window into what's going on in the book, first of all, I should tell you the promo website that we just gave, birthrightsunlimited.com, is something really clever that JD did, which was to put up a parody, faux website for a company that is such a large part of the book. It's a character in its own right, Birthrights Unlimited, which is dabbling in genetic technologies. And so its website is tongue-in-cheek what a website of such a company might look like were it to be put together. It's quite chilling, actually. You look at it and go, oh, yeah, I would definitely sign up and let them do things. So it's it was very clever, JD. Let's go ahead and let you have a glimpse into the world of Biohack by playing a bit of chapter one.
Chapter one, the Vatican, August 5th. The three dark figures skimmed across the cold marble floor of St. Peter's Basilica. Caden raised her eyes to Michelangelo's majestic dome, challenging the stares of the saints overhead. She genuflected, crossed herself, and smiled. Score one for the damned, she thought. Caden led Bunt and Nico into the confessional, where the advance team had stashed uniforms of the San Pietrini, the Vatican work crew. They changed and found the door at the south wall of the basilica that led down to the Roman necropolis. Caden inserted the first passkey into the latch, and the heavy wooden door groaned open.
So that clip is more on the death side of things as the characters involved in that scene descend into the catacombs beneath the Vatican in search of things that are there. And JD's whole book is about DNA and its manipulation and what it all means for us. We have a great piece in the rundown today. And in fact, I commend you to read a lot of great reading material that we've put together for this show today. You can find it all at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're episode 426 today. And there's a piece in there that talks about works of science fiction
and what they do for us. You know, are they really about the future? And the author there says, no, they're not really about the future. Here's an exact quote. By making our everyday world into something strange and alien, science fiction hopes that we will question and change our society. Science fiction does not invite us to be prophets, but anthropologists making sense of a complex and troubling foreign culture, which we may eventually come to recognize as our own. And so when reading or watching science fiction, look for the moments when the future seems shocking, repulsive, and alien to everything you hold dear. Ask what these moments correspond to in your world. And so I think that that's a really great way to look at the issues that J.D. has raised in his book. And a lot of those issues have to do with new gene editing technologies known as CRISPR. We've discussed CRISPR on the show before, primarily because the people who came up with this technique did so. There seem to be two different groups, correct, Glenn, that one originating from UC Berkeley, one elsewhere that I don't remember, who claimed to have come up with CRISPR and have had some back and forth about who should be credited with its discovery. But whoever discovered it, it is forging ahead and being used, isn't it, Glenn?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's in that long tradition of genetic discovery where it kind of starts and nobody's really sure who has, well, there are various people who are very sure about who has discovered it and what they've discovered and what it's going to do. But as the chips sort of start to fall out, it turns out that it's much, much more complicated.
So tell us, give us the 10,000 foot view, if you would, why CRISPR is important and what is being done with it.
Well, CRISPR-Cas9 gives scientists the power, and not only in principle, but now in a number of actual pretty good demonstrations, to take genetic material and insert it into the genome of an individual reproductive cell. So you can work in principle, you'd think, with, you know, and people's imaginations are sparked because you should be able in principle, and I want to just keep saying in principle, to modify the DNA of an organism from the get-go. So you'd start with an embryo, and moving forward, that individual would take up genetic information that you want it to have, and it could be taken from another individual, from another species entirely. And that same technology can be used, again, in principle, and in a few cases, it's been demonstrated to be usable with adults and any other, you know, organism at any stage in order to accomplish some of the things that people originally hoped gene therapy would do. We've been talking since the 60s about a sort of day that was going to come when we'd be able to edit our DNA, you know, with a typewriter, right? We'd be able to go in and say, okay, we found the gene for this or the gene for that, and we're going to remove it. CRISPR-Cas9, in principle, gives us that, what begins to be the first real technology that's within shooting distance of that. And it also introduces all kinds of new possibilities for making biologics and drugs and new kinds of therapy.
So one of the issues that is at the core of Biohack is this company that we mentioned, which, by the way, never, ever took a pledge not to be evil. putting forth and marketing services to people to enhance their children. So it seems like where we are with gene editing technologies today is looking primarily at the way that they can address imminent problems, imminent health problems, eliminate things that are desperate and important in the way of disease.
But, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to say, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And one of the things that really JD's website does beautifully, I haven't seen anyone do since about 1998 when the movie Gattaca came out with Ethan Hawke and I think it was Uma Thurman and Washington Post and New York Times both had full page ads for a fake company that would allow parents to make a new baby. And very much like his website, they didn't have a little warning on the top right that said, "We're just joking." And so it was just scary enough that it scared the bejesus out of everybody, not just parents and potential parents and grandparents and priests and rabbis and so on, but also journalists. And it really should make us pause and wonder if we were going to have the ability to go in and change the kind of offspring we'd have to prevent really terrible diseases, how would we stop ourselves? And what's the continuum that begins with eliminating, a gene from a child that would potentially result in a life, that's short and full of suffering, all the way over to the other side of trying to create a genius? We've been puzzling over that really since the 1940s in science fiction. And J.D.'s book, I think, is the first one to really be sophisticated about the way that all of these technologies connect to each other and the way in which some of these things are, maybe even more eerie than we realize.
Right.
Denise, if I could build on that, I forgot who it was who said, if your book, if you want to send a message, use Western Union, right? But I've been thinking about this idea for like 20 years about writing a book on this subject, because it just seems like the entire subject of genetic engineering is really fascinating on a number of different levels. But I had to wait until this sort of became more into the realm of science instead of science fiction. I wanted this to not have that kind of barrier as to like, well, this is like way off in the future. It's never going to happen. So it's a fun little story. I wanted to make it a little bit more disturbing. So as soon as CRISPR came along, it seemed like, well, now it's not really science fiction anymore. You can actually use these technologies in a really precise way to not just screen for genetic diseases, but to actually add positive influences or genetic enrichment to a pre-embryo. So, I set this book in the mid 2020s, and I created this website, Birthrights Unlimited. The only thing that sort of gives it away at the bottom of the page is copyright 2025. So you have to sort of look at it a little bit carefully to sort of figure out, oh, wait a minute, this is not a real company.
Right.
But the idea was basically that this can be scary stuff, and as I think we're going to be talking about, we've got to have we've got to open up a conversation about what this means for society. And so I wanted to do it in an entertaining way through this kind of, fast-paced thriller. But in a way, it's kind of like the opposite of Brave New World. It's Brave New World, right, in reverse. So instead of the government deciding your genetic destiny, it's more like what happens if unfettered capitalism takes hold and the free market prevails. And, there could be some really disturbing things that come out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're going to have to let us know, JD, when you start getting emails from people who want to sign up because they don't get that this is a fake site. who absolutely buy into the fact that, oh yeah, this all sounds great, which is one of the really disturbing things about your book. The company Birthrights Unlimited knows that they are onto something that is going to be in high demand, and they really work that, and they, their marketing pitches, et cetera, go right at the emotions of a parent. You do so much for your children already. Why wouldn't you want to give them all the advantages you possibly can? And they really pitch it in that kind of a vein, to the point where you as a parent would say, oh yeah, why wouldn't I? I'd be depriving my child if I didn't.
And that's why I set up an email address for Sterling Waterhouse, the villain and the CEO of Birthrights Unlimited. So we'll see if I send it as me or as Sterling. We'll see what happens when I start getting these emails.
Oh, goodness.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I was just going to say, I think that one of the reasons why it is so plausible that we would end up in a world where the, you know, the market could actually be the driving force and not some Big Brother sort of phenomenon, is because that's where we are now. I mean, you know, we live in a society in the United States, at least, where if you can afford private school, if you can afford to, you know, have Adderall, if you can afford to, you know, the list of available ways in which you can improve the possibilities of your children is limitless. And, you know, whereas in the 1980s and 1990s, people looked at this technology as it was beginning to emerge, in vitro fertilization, let's make a test tube baby, et cetera. And they wondered, as JD said, about the science fiction possibilities. Now, it is very common to see women who and men who are at a different age point than was even technically possible 20 years ago, considering, you know, when to start their families. All of us, I think, know families that are much more unconventional than they used to be. I mean, if we're going to be fundamental about it, the nature of a family and what it is to have a kid has changed so much so fast. You know, if I used to say if the birds and the bees was the model that I was taught as a little kid, you know, try to think of what the story would be now. Is it the ants and the termites? Maybe if you're raised by daycare, you know, is it the racehorses? Well, maybe if you were raised with identical kids and, you know, we're not so far away from maybe cloning and, you know, it just goes on and on. So I think it's entirely likely that the model we have now, which is totally unregulated reproductive technology, there aren't even really studies on the outcomes of the use of reproductive technology. That's where we're headed. I'm not actually against having those things sort of remain unregulated because we don't have a way to regulate them, although some of us have suggested, you know, slightly different approaches to it. I think the real issue is that we haven't educated people in our society to think about those technologies in terms of their effect on children. So what's the children's story you tell to a kid who you've used CRISPR on, right? What's the children's story you tell to a kid who's – I mean, this happens all the time that you have kids who are made from surrogate genetic material – DNA from a surrogate mom who's in another country who's been engaged by contract to raise a baby that has the DNA of one of the parents who will be raising the kid. What's their children's story? What do you say about the kid who's made from sperm in a sperm bank from a father who's already dead? I mean, I can – in the course of my 25 years working in bioethics, I can't count the number of stories that I've heard. And I can barely count the number of times I've had to go on television to talk about those stories. And that, I think, is a measure of the fact that we have not yet figured out how we're going to educate each other and what kind of families we want to see going forward. And so we're probably going to get the ones that look most interesting on real websites that'll come out in the not too distant future, like the one JD has really cleverly mocked up.
Denise, yeah. I have kind of an interesting use case for this. So I have twin boy nephews, and when they were young kids, like, it was totally impossible to tell them apart. You know, when you stand them right next to each other, you had no idea who was Andrew and who was Michael, right? So I think one of the kind of interesting use cases early on for the technology might be if parents who are going to have identical twins might, and this is like a scene in Biohack, might want to decide to have one of the kids have blue eyes and one of the kids have green eyes. So I can totally see parents doing that if it's left to the free market. And we have to sort of decide whether or not this is like a legitimate kind of use case or this is trivial enough that it's not going to be allowed by society. So, you know, I think the early cases of CRISPR technology, if it were left to evil companies like Birthrights Unlimited, would be, you know, to let parents trick out their test tube baby with all the latest enhancements ranging from eye color to hair color to skin color to possibly height, optimal body mass, BMI. You're probably not going to be able to influence intelligence all that much right away or life expectancy, but that might be coming further down the road. So, but, you know, just within a handful of years, this stuff is going to be possible, if not possible already today. Remember, CRISPR is only 6 years old. So who knows where it's going to be, you know, 8, 10, 20 years from now.
Right. Well, I think you've just given us our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, JD. It's going to be no more parent trap, because In that kind of a world, the twins can't fool their parents, right? We're going to deprive twins and triplets and quads of the ability to pull one over on mom and dad. Patty Duke, huh? Okay. No, not at all. So no more parrot trap is our first phrase for this show. We put these phrases in case you are watching or listening to receive professional credit in your field. Which some of our listeners do. If you're a lawyer doing that, head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, and you'll get some further guidance on how to apply for credit in your jurisdiction if you're in the United States. Yes. So, Glenn, with all that in mind, how close are we to a Birthrights Unlimited coming along and saying, of course you want to eliminate genetic diseases such as Tay-Sachs, such as the BRCA gene for breast cancer? You don't want your children to labor under those burdens in life if you can avoid them. And as long as you're here, you know, if you're going to have twins, let's give them different eye colors. Let's make them taller. Let's, you know, what, if any of this is possible at this point?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question, and I've been trying to answer that question for more than 20 years. I call it the under the hood effect, and I've long suspected that what will begin to happen is that, you know, things like JD's website will be driven by demand. I've always wondered, and hang on for the end of this because I'm wrong, but I've always sort of suspected, right, that we'd have parents who came in just as you described. They have a legitimate, well-understood reason to be afraid that there's going to be a hereditary disease, that they're going to have a kid who's born with something that they then will say, well, hey, you know, what if we could have sorted our embryos or used CRISPR and just taken that one bad gene out? And well, as long as we're here, we'll do 1, 2, 3, 4. That was one of the premises of Gattaca. It's a pretty prominent recurring theme in science fiction. But what in my own research, I've been unable to demonstrate anything like that. For example, at one point we surveyed people who are trying to have children the old-fashioned way, people who had been in vitro fertilization for a while, and people who adopted kids. And then we put alongside them just some random jurors. And we asked them all, what would you, if you could wave a magic wand, what would you be willing to do for your offspring? And we suspected, of course, that people who'd been at it longer or who had used more advanced technology would be more likely to say, hey, if I'm under the hood, then let's eliminate this thing and maybe that thing, and I'd like to be taller and where are the blue eyes and et cetera. But we couldn't find it. And you know, honestly, I don't think anybody's been able to find it. As I said earlier, part of the reason for that is that there's nobody studying this stuff. There's a, you might call it the abortion effect that kind of surrounds this whole area, because those who are opposed to abortion sort of have to be opposed to reproductive technologies that involve doing anything to an embryo. That has prevented federal funding since, well, for at least 20 years now. And that means that the people who want to study this have to kind of pay for it with their, you know, pocket money. I'm exaggerating, but only a tiny bit. And that actually has really gotten in the way. So those of us who work in this area kind of do it, you know, with candles in the dark of night and try as hard as we can to piece together enough information to let us see what could happen. Everybody is scared to death that what you described could come to pass, that somebody would put out, you know, a website that says we'll do X, Y, and Z. And the reason that people are so scared is because, of course, there was a genius sperm bank not that long ago. You know, for it operated for at least 20 years, and it offered the sperm donation services of Nobel Prize winners and leading athletes and politicians and so on. And until it was shut down, the sperm bank, which was named incidentally for the founder of eugenics, you know, produced nobody knows quite how many kids.
Wow. I did not know that that existed, nor that it had been shut down. But I actually, from a bioethical standpoint, it's different than what we're talking about, right? No, nothing's being manipulated there. It's simply making a resource available, presumably with with approval, right?
You've really nailed it there. I mean, I think that's the thing legally, right? That's the thing that always kind of stops us cold is there something that really matters about the distinction between the choices that you make when you're using a super high technology versus whether you're not? And if so, what is the difference, right? Because, you know, people pick their spouses, they choose the people that they'll get gametes from and have since recorded history. The mm-hmm. you know, the Quran and the Bible were filled with stories about sperm donation and so on, and they've always been there. Is that low tech and therefore not an issue? I think a lot of us in bioethics sort of feel like that we need to draw a continuum, because just like, you know, you can enhance your kid by helping him study more, you can enhance your kid by giving him Adderall, maybe you can enhance your kid by et cetera, et cetera. If you were to enhance your kid by giving them a gene to allow them to focus more and using CRISPR-Cas9 to give it to them when they were 14, let's just, you know, hypothesize you could do that. Would that really be fundamentally different from being able to invest in a very expensive private school? Most of the arguments that say it is different fall apart when they've been tried in court cases. They fall apart, and they also fall apart sort of under careful scrutiny. I think, you know, we get too obsessed with the uniqueness and specialness of the technology. But, you know, by the same token, if you can apply a sort of chemical razor blade to the cells of any given person and immediately change the color of their eyes, that's going to be striking, and it is going to be fundamentally different from what we do now.
I think I've got an explanation for why Glenn isn't seeing this in these kinds of sit-downs with potential parents who are talking about what they would like to pass on to their kids. And that is because of the go-first phenomenon. Nobody wants to be the first to go. But if they start seeing this spread through our society, they're going to start thinking, well, why not me too? So, you know, if you sit down with a breast cancer survivor, who knows that the chances of her passing on breast cancer to her daughter is 32 times higher than a regular member of society. And you say, well, you know, how about if we prevent that at birth by eliminating the BRCA gene? She'll say, of course, I want you to do that, right? So, you know, it is like Glenn said, a continuum from that kind of disease prevention to enhancements, to, you know, kids who were picked on in the playground because they had red hair, and maybe the parents today don't want to let their kids have the same kind of experience. So maybe they don't want their kids to have red hair, even if they've married somebody and they both have red hair, right? Or right. Somebody with big ears, or, you know, parents, even I think parents who lost a child might want to consider cloning that child if, you know, they lost a child at an early age. It wasn't through any kind of genetic disease. It was just like a tragic accident, like appears in Biohack. I can see a lot of parents considering doing that to bringing back their loved one. So, you know, we have to, again, decide as a society whether or not we're going to allow that stuff to happen. And where do you draw the line? We had an interesting conversation on the subject this week on the DNA Today podcast, where somebody from the Society for Genetics and Society was saying the line should be drawn at not allowing anybody to start down this slippery slope. So I think we're going to talk later about the case in Ukraine where somebody now has a baby, has three genetic parents in a way, right? So they said that shouldn't be allowed. And, my point of view was, well, you know, I think parents are going to sort of demand this. If you can't have your own biological child through no fault of your own, but a simple genetic fix at the pre-embryo stage will fix that, it doesn't really matter to them that much that you're sort of creating this kind of CRISPR technology that allows you to go down this route. They're only concerned about their own family.
Right. And I want to talk about the law and policy and regulation that will need to develop around these technologies that is just at its infancy, or as Glenn was saying, just flat doesn't exist at this point. And I think that go first mentality that you mentioned, JD, is important to this. Who will go first? Someone will. And it's probably not going to be within the United States, I'm guessing, because of the hesitancy that Glenn voiced and mentioned and identified. But we have a really fascinating piece in our discussion points for today that's called CRISPR Goes Global, A Snapshot of Rules, Policies, and Attitudes. It's published in the bulletin.org. And it's really long, but if you're interested in sort of where things stand now, I encourage you to check it out. And where it really comes down is that there are different approaches developing all over the world. There is a very transnational environment to all of this as far as sharing of information, but there's no real uniformity as to what should and should not be happening. So as far as going first, someone will. we need to be prepared for how we're, you know, locally going to cope with that.
I think I completely agree. I think the it's been very interesting. I mean, you want to talk about a crazy ride since the human cloning possibility really sort of got floated in the wake of the announcement by Ian Wilmot and co. that they had cloned Dolly the sheep. There have been a lot, and I mean a lot of craziness out there as people have said, yep, I'm going to clone one. The UFO cult, the Raelians declared they were going to clone a child, set up a shop in a little downtown area in a little state, finally got raided by the FDA. I can remember debating another cloning scientist who said for years he was going to clone himself and went on a speaker tour to prove it. No one's ever cloned anyone, and I have to say, that we know of. But there's sort of that category, the technologies where, yeah, it is entirely possible that someone is eventually going to show up with a child that has been engineered in some way, probably with CRISPR Cas9, probably for a specific purpose. But what makes that so odious, what invokes the kind of yuck factor around those technologies, clumping them broadly as technologies where you'd have a lone wolf who wants to be first, is that the amount of human sacrifice, as it were, that's involved in getting to the first is not palatable enough that you could get a reputable doctor to do it. On the other side of things, though, you know, the technologies that get us closer and closer, as JD is describing, closer and closer to actually seeing a real change, a revolution even, in how we make babies, those things are going to happen. And it's, I think, easy to see how they happen if you watch American healthcare more generally. Remember when bad breath was first called simple chronic halitosis? Right. I mean,
yes.
And on the chat, I'm watching all these hilarious comments about gingers and red hair and so on. And, you know, it's so interesting, isn't it? How things go in and out of fashion. Things are treated as art and not art. Well, it's also true that people think of things as diseases at a certain moment. And I think what's likely to happen is that we'll creep toward using more technologies in reproduction as we associate traits more and more with a sort of a lack of ability or with ultimately a disease. And, you know, we've seen that for years in so many different contexts around cognitive impairments. I think that's probably where we'll see this emerge first, but that's just my guess.
Right. And I think that's such a good point. And that is something that we're going to need to think about, as a society, what's going to be okay, what's not going to be okay. JD has a very telling moment in his story where you're going along as the reader, seeing people, okay, we're going to eliminate disease. Okay, we're going to add some traits that we think are desirable for some reason, but they're fairly benign, eye color, hair color. And then we encounter a couple that want to do something to their children, which, you know, most people would agree is disadvantaging the would-be child. But this parental couple feels otherwise about it. And so it sort of makes you stand back and go, whoa, are we going to let people do that? And what was helpful for me in thinking through all of this is thinking about what we let people do to themselves now and the array of body modifications through plastic surgery and otherwise that people are pursuing now as we speak. I have a few things we can look at on extreme plastic surgeries, which J.D. rightly points out, you know, these are people on the fringe. We don't need to think that everyone in society is going to try and make themselves look like an elf, for example, or like a Barbie doll. But these are things that people think are desirable for themselves, and the law does not stop them from going out and spending silly amounts of money to, you know, what most of us would think of as it's self-expression, and more power to them, I suppose. But it gives you pause to think, you know, I certainly don't want to be the society that says you can't do that to yourself, as long as it's not, you know, unhealthy to you or those around you in an overt way. But are we going to let people who are capable of making those kinds of judgments make them for their offspring? What do you think about that, Glenn?
I think it's I love the way you put it. I think it's the exact question we'll find ourselves answering. And, you know, mm-hmm. we're looking at a change, no matter which side of the political world you sit on in the United States. It's pretty obvious that more and more technologies that are more and more expensive are going to be available to a tiny fraction of people. So I think it's very likely that we're going to find ourselves in a world where a small number of people are able to make those choices and a very large number of people aren't. And in fact, we already sort of see a microcosm of that now because there are 30,000 kids who are unadopted at any given moment in the United States. And so, mm-hmm. you know, people who are thinking about parenting and considering, you know, improving their kids and contemplating the use of technologies that, you know, even in a cheap world, you'd be lucky to have more than $10,000 or $15,000 in insurance coverage available to you for, you could be spending to do the kinds of things we're talking about $500,000. And you know, we could say that eventually it'll get cheaper, but reproductive technology has not gotten less expensive in the whole time it's been available. So I think, you know, I think one of the fears that is very real and that JD captures in some ways and others have captured too, that everybody should have, is that those most disadvantaged in the reproductive revolution are going to be the folks who suddenly find themselves unable to do things because someone else has been engineered to do them. And maybe the second place for those most disadvantaged will be the people who've been engineered themselves. Because, you know, can you imagine being that child who is born with a designer brain and your parent mm-hmm. intends that you'll be really good at math? Well, you know, good luck to you if you like poetry. You know, and one of the best stories about reproductive technology is in the original eugenics literature. It was suggested by Darwin's cousin that we should aim toward a specific set of people as we're reproducing. And then, you know, when that book was later edited in some countries, they replaced people with others that were more politically palatable. There are all kinds of traits you could change, but, you know, having lungs that let you breathe underwater wouldn't be such a great situation if there's plastic in the ocean. You know, we make all kinds of short-sighted mistakes with low tech all the time. Those who are born with great expectations and highly engineered genetic abilities are probably going to have the same kind of worries that, you know, we have about genetically modified corn. It's not that it's bad, but, you know, most of it you can't eat or it's lost all flavor.
Mm-hmm. Matt, have we just stunned you into silence here? I want to let you jump in.
This is the silence of pure enjoyment, so we're all good. I do think that the other side, you know, the latest thing is, like, you know, how is insurance going to pick this up? You know, for the disease states that are clearly detrimental and are extremely costly to have a child with, you know, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or something or leukemia, you're going to have issues where you know, insurance is probably going to push for some sort of modification where if you're able to do that with the CRISPR technology. The other thing is we're living in a world where not only is CRISPR something available, but we have, with next generation sequencing, we have the ability to actually understand vast data sets about how our DNA, you know, affects us. Obviously, there's tons of environmental things that go into what becomes of a person, but you're at a point where both of those sides, your ability to modify and your ability to understand what the modification is going to do, is it's an interesting place to be.
Absolutely. Interesting and incredibly complicated. Health insurance companies, you know, everybody, we have laws passed now in almost every state and even a federal law about genetic discrimination. But there literally is not a single case on genetic. Well, I take that back. There are a couple cases on the record that have made it to the appeals courts, but there's not a real case. And there's certainly not what everyone expected, a gigantic number of cases in which people have been discriminated against on the basis of their genes. And part of the reason for that is that if you talk to a CEO of an insurance company, they'll tell you point blank right to your face that they don't want to touch it because the insurance world, genetic information provides them with a completely different kind of calculation than they're used to. Even for life insurance, there's been a real reluctance to touch any real genetic testing, let alone gene therapy associated information. And on the other side of things, even as an insurance company, if you're talking to a potential parent who is trying to avoid a disease, even if that disease in a possible future child could cost the insurance company a lot of money, for almost all the diseases that one would normally think of, that cost will only be incurred in 5 or 8 years. The average American is only on a health plan for about 2 years now, 2.5. So most insurance companies look at that and they say, okay, if I'm going to use reproductive technology, there's a greater chance of a complicated pregnancy. Possibly there'll be issues for the child early on, and then when the ultimate loss hits, we probably won't be the ones covering it. These are issues that will happen in England and Canada and Germany and, you know, across the world and other places. But in our country, we've got such a crazy insurance approach where health
traits the way that we did in dog breeding generations ago. I'm a little confused. The dogs have not fared well, the purebred dogs. A lot of that has to do with the fact that they've been inbred, but does some of it have to do with the fact that the traits were selected to begin with?
I think it does. And I think it's partially also a kind of myopia that, that at least when I talk about ethical issues and enhancement, I point to over and over again, it's so hard to know what it is that forms a child. It's so hard to know whether a trait that we like is just specific to our time and our culture and place. It's hard and frankly, maybe appropriately hard. So if you imagine a world where everybody's has the ability to choose the same set of sort of vanilla traits for their child, we do have data on that, and it does suggest that lots of people would make eugenic choices. So we'd have a lot more children who look the same and have, you know, blue eyes and blonde hair. I mean, and frankly, you can already see that in reproductive technology to some degree, because what are the most valued sperm donors? Norwegians, you know. Attractive, I guess. I mean, yeah, and there's this. It's really sad for guys like me. Yeah. So, but I mean, I think ultimately for humankind as a species, we would be crazy not to be afraid of having so much power and so little wisdom. You were talking earlier about, well, what will we do to regulate this? And the truth is we don't regulate it really at all. And when we regulate it, the place where these kinds of issues are discussed most is the family courts. And so, you know, Ian Wilmot, the guy who cloned the sheep, and I wrote a book called The Human Cloning Debate. And we argued that maybe the only way we'll ever be able to regulate these kinds of technologies, from cloning to CRISPR to gene therapy used on embryos, et cetera, maybe the only way we'll ever be able to do that is to employ something that's very much like the discussion that goes on when someone wants to adopt a child or when parents are getting divorced, et cetera, because that's the only place in our society that we have a large literature and a long history. And that should scare you to death, because that's not the place where we do our best work.
Right. So your thought is that it would be sort of a case by case. Is this a responsible decision being made with a court weighing in?
I think that's exactly right, because yeah, the debate, the way it looks when you get people fighting, and I've been in lots of these fights over the years, and the way that, mm-hmm. that it looks is you've got the libertarians on one side saying, don't, you know, that this is just an extension of abortion ethics and abortion law, and then on, so leave me alone, basically. And on the other side, you have this kind of hodgepodge of folks who are concerned. For example, one of the ways that it's been put in, Dworkin pretty famously described it as potential future and future potential people, is sort of highly theoretical concern about the future and whether or not those who aren't yet conceived have a right to a particular kind of future. And one of the arguments that Joel Feinberg makes is that children should have a right to an open future. I mean, it sounds great, but it's just as crazy in the end as the position that nobody has any right to tell anyone something. Both these positions are positions no real parent would hold. Real right. parents get down and dirty in the world of trying to figure out how to make a good life for their child. And if they can enhance, they do. So the question is, how are we going to deploy notions of fairness that work? And I think we probably are going to have a very, very hard time if that opportunity comes to us with our current political environment.
Okay, so we've talked about modifying our offspring and the good and the potentially bad of all of that. You mentioned, Glenn, that we don't know if anyone has cloned a human. No one has come forward and said they have done so, but the technology certainly exists, correct?
It does, but I don't. I will be shocked if I hear that someone is cloned in the next 10 years because, again, the sacrifice involved in getting to a clone of a human is mammoth. I was giving a talk at Cold Spring Harbor not too long ago with one of the guys who tried to clone a rhesus monkey at Oregon. And didn't succeed. And one of the things that he says over and over again is that there are just fundamental problems with particular kinds of animals that we haven't figured out how to overcome. With a human being, imagine, right? Imagine if what we had happened with Dolly, you've got 200, 300 attempts, and you've got all kinds of things that are sheep-ish coming. That's an awful.
God, that's terrible.
Coming, you know, nobody's going to be willing to risk a human baby in that way. And yes. I, you know, maybe except maybe China, because, you know, I'm reading these hilarious comments and someone pointed out that there's a Chinese doctor trying to do a head transplant at the moment. And that is true. So maybe in China, but they're not going to get a successful offspring without surprising the heck out of most of the people I know.
And it's not legal in the United States.
Pardon me?
It wouldn't be legal in the United States.
There are actually cloning bans, not only in several states, but there is a what amounts to a federal cloning ban that was passed. But it's really a ban on a certain kind of research. It's a kind of really confusing possibility that you could somehow ban trying to make a child. So that's never been tested that
right.
I know of.
If I could differ a little bit with Glenn. So I think we are going to see human clones within our lifetimes. Okay. I don't think it's going to happen here. I think it's going to happen elsewhere in China or Russia or Ukraine or some other country without the same kind of bioethical strictures. And when it does happen, you know, don't expect, you know, the scientists or the client to hold a big news conference to announce that their child is going to become the human equivalent of Dolly the sheep. You know, you can see why they wouldn't want that to happen. So it's going to be done in stealth. We're not going to know what happens when it happens. The technology has come, you know, Dolly the sheep was cloned in an era before CRISPR. Today it's much, you know, I wouldn't say trivial, but, you know, it's not going to take you 200 attempts to get a successful human clone. It's going to take a much, much, you know, fewer number of steps to make that happen. And so we have to sort of look at where all this is heading. And I think we're almost entering it. I would say 2012 is the beginning of the age of genetics. We're actually entering a new age where at the very infancy, we're going to be doing much more with bioinformatics. We're going to be using quantum artificial intelligence to sort through millions of sequenced genomes to identify exactly where certain gene regions are that lead to, you know, higher intelligence or a perfect body or a full head of hair, you know, just mapping people's phenotypes against their genotype. And all of that is data. I think it might be helpful to actually step back for not everybody who's a genetic scientist in the audience to understand. You know, when I began writing this book, I was probably alongside, 99% of the public who thought, if you're going to clone, like, you know, if I lose a skin cell from my lips or my fingernails or earwax or something, and an evil biotech laboratory got a hold of it, I would be able to clone the lips or the ear or something like that. But in fact, Glenn isn't correct that, you know, each of us carries around 30 trillion cells, and the vast, vast majority of those 30 trillion cells contain your entire genetic profile of all 6 billion, 3 billion base pairs. Isn't that right?
Well, it is to the degree that we know it is, right, of course, but as you know better than I, the epigenetic factors are increasingly important too. So what percentage of our cells actually have that whole complement of the genetic material that we inherited is literally anyone's guess. But probably most of our cells have most of the DNA that we inherited.
Go ahead, JD.
That's why I think we have to start thinking about where we're leaving our DNA, right? So there's a scene in the book where somebody is actually some operatives are sent out to collect the genetic remains or detritus of Hollywood celebrities. So they go to, hair salons and other places where, they're sloughing off this stuff. So we have to start thinking about, I think I read somewhere that Vladimir Putin actually has a number of bodyguards who actually make sure that whenever he visits a certain place, he doesn't leave any of his DNA behind, because God knows what might happen if that DNA were cloned. And I think the president has the same kind of safeguards in place.
So
Obama, you can't, if he drinks from your water glass after you leave his he leaves your restaurant, you're not allowed to take the water glass home with you. I think we're starting to see that in a lot of cases, not only with the president but with Hollywood celebrities, and it's going to be coming to a neighborhood near you soon too.
I've been thinking about that issue in the context that it comes up in your book, where not to spoil too much of the book, the reason that things are being collected is to provide an array of options that you can select for your child. But what this discussion is making me remember is that hilarious movie Sleeper by Woody Allen, where they have the nose of their former leader and they need to clone the nose.
Right.
They're attempting to clone the nose. So, yes, DNA can be used for a myriad of purposes. On the cloning front, examples.
Are you going to bring up Barbara Streisand?
I'm bringing up Barbara Streisand, and I'm bringing up the fact that not only did she clone three dogs from, actually, she attempted to clone four. There was a litter. She had to go and explain. The media was getting this wrong. She thought that the media kept reporting she has done multiple cloning procedures in order to get multiple dogs. And she came out and explained, no, it's more like IVF. You implant multiples so that there's a litter, and there's just one litter of dogs. So her cloning experience wound up with a litter of four dogs. Three survived. She kept two. One she adopted out. And that this procedure, as outrageous as it might seem, is, as you say, JD, capitalism is rushing right in. There are at least a couple of companies out there who will clone your animal for you for exorbitant fees at the moment. But they will do it. There's a place in Seoul, Korea, called Soam Biotech Research that has cloned some, it says, it has cloned some 800 pets and charges $100,000 each. There's another company called Viagen Pets that is doing it. So we must have come to the point where we're not producing things that are dog-ish. We're producing dogs. That the science has come far enough that this is becoming more mainstream in one biological arena. Is that right, Glenn?
It is. That is right. I've actually visited the SOAM facility a couple of times. I even have if I'd known you were going to bring it up, I'd have brought down. I have a little stuffed dog. Clone that they give their visitors to show them. One of the things that they did, which is to make sure that the clones had a coloration in their paws. And, you know, they do it, and they had in mind a number of socially positive reasons. For example, producing dogs that could sniff explosives better or drugs better, or most notably cancer, a dog that would have the really highly attuned ability to pick out the presence of, you know, those whatever it is that's in our breath that tells of the future in which someone's going to have cancer. And, you know, I mean, and it does sound like a pretty well-formed market at this point, but it is nuts. And I don't mean to say it's nuts because it's wrong morally, but just because it is ludicrously expensive to do so and has been since the very first time that it was deployed. There's a pretty prominent docu-comedy, a true story called Tabloid, about one of the big successes that company had. And it was I won't go into it, but watch the movie. Tabloid tells the story of a woman who purportedly kidnapped a man and kept him in prison for years and years. And then after she was forced to let him out, she lost her dog and had to have another one. And it follows this process through all of its parts. And it's kind of scary.
Right. Denise, I don't know if you can put up the photo of Barbara Streisand's dog's tombstone or not, but one thing we should point out is that when she says that my little girls were looking at their mother pictured on her tombstone, Barbara's miseducating her dogs because Samantha is not their mother. Samantha is their twin sister, you know, later born twin sister. So I think we have to get the genetics right. We have to start making sure we don't start confusing people about what a real mother or a parent is.
Right.
Just because you have the materials from a progenitor, it doesn't mean, you know, if you're actually identical to that person or to that dog, you are actually the twin, not the son or the daughter.
Right. Right. Well, this all sort of ties back with JD's book, because the way that cloning comes up there is because of a lost loved one and the desire to bring that person back. I mean, beyond desire, the passion and compulsion to bring that person back because of grief and loss. And you know, presumably this is Barbara Streisand's justification for cloning her pet rather than going to the shelter and adopting one of the many, many pets that needs a good home. And I mean, we're going to see similar kinds of, in fact, we've already discussed it today, you know, is it ethical to engineer create a pregnancy that wouldn't otherwise have been possible through reproductive technology when there's so many children who need to be adopted? I mean, I hate to compare people with dogs, but it's a similar kind of argument. But in the human situation, I think we're all probably much more ready to give the person some slack, saying, yeah, we get your loss and your grief, and we get why you would go down that road bioethically. Do you think, Glenn, that there's a strong ethical argument to be made to say, we get your grief and we're sorry, but no?
I think right now, with the current level of assumed risk, regardless of how far we've come since Dolly, we haven't come far enough that anybody could expect that they'd have a clone without at least a few pretty awful halfways. I think right now, if you assume the risk, then yeah, absolutely, no is the only answer. But if it were safe, your question is the right one. aren't there a few cases? Isn't there? And I think there are. And actually, Ian Wilmot and I came to the conclusion in what we wrote that, you know, as strange as it might sound, the people who make a pretty persuasive case for having access to cloning are people who don't want a clone at all. That it's people who really, really want to reproduce, were seeking to actively to reproduce with someone, and would select, you know, a clone of that person because it's the only way they could have a biological relative with, or a child, as it were, with that person, is one case that we talked about. I mean, in other words, you know, the scary part about cloning is the people who want to make a clone. Right, it's that name, right? It's the, you know, if they'd never used the word clone, if they just said a nuclear transplant derived offspring or something, then we, I think, never have gotten into this crazy conflation. Those who want to clone scare me to death, but the people who really need or want a biological relationship to someone, I think, you know, plenty of cases where, if under the right circumstances, if the safety issues are right, I think most people would really feel for someone who had that desire. And even if we wouldn't wish it as a general social procedure, might imagine a world where it could be used.
Right. Glenn, you did some work with the Human Genome Project, you told us. Do you know George Church?
I do. I've actually been on a stage with George Church several times.
Yes. He has a great piece that we've highlighted in our discussion points for today called 8 Questions to Ask Before Human Genetic Engineering Goes Mainstream, among the many things that I recommend that people read in our discussion points for today. And one of the things he raises there is something we've touched on in the show and I wanted to drill down a little deeper on, and that is the fact that we are perhaps perpetuating class and wealth and income disparities through these technologies. And the way I wanted to kind of get into this discussion is going to seem a little weird, but it's something that we all understand and have probably all run up against at some point in our lives if we ever go to the dentist. And that is the fact that the metal amalgam fillings that you can get to fill a cavity cost far less than the composite fillings that you can choose. And as Matt brought up earlier, the metal amalgam fillings are usually covered by insurance and the composite ones are not, which means that you have to, if you want the composite filling, which is a little bit more attractive, I know people who think they're better for you long-term health-wise. You know, my child will never have a metal filling probably because they're just not the preferred one that dentists want to put in these days. But, you know, being my age, I have kind of half and half. My fillings were done a long time ago and half I've gotten now when I can afford to pay the difference between what my insurance covers and because, you know, this technology now exists. So I feel like we're sort of in that same strange realm where the people are going, there's technology available that anyone in their right mind would prefer, but maybe their insurance isn't going to cover it. And you go from there. There's also a really interesting piece at Forbes that talks about not only are these technologies more expensive, but if we're manipulating the innate qualities that seem to advantage people, like we mentioned height, or attractiveness, that this makes you able to succeed better in life. Are we also, you know, the way he puts it is manipulating the innate abilities of those with the most would additionally extend the differentiation and the advantage. So societally and ethically, Glenn, how do we deal with these issues?
Well, I think they're an extension of the issues we already face, and your dental example is a great example of that. You know, Norm Daniels and John, working on the sort of American philosopher John Rawls' theories about what's just, which is pretty much the only theory anybody's used to talk about this. People have tried to draw a continuum where you've got treating something that's awful on one side and becoming a 6'5" blonde Norwegian on the other. other, and you know, where these are wishes, right? And we say socially that we've sort of constructed a world where in the middle are these things that are fuzzy, like vaccinations that don't really cure anything, giving a piano tuner more physical therapy after his hand is broken so he can, you know, have a better than average hand because he needs it, you know. And then on the far, again, on the outside is Botox and, you know, genetic enhancement and so on. The problem, of course, is we do live in this space now. So everybody has bad dental insurance. The dentists tell you that it's just yours, but literally everyone has bad dental insurance because that industry, frankly, is not subject to some of the same discussions and debates. And so everybody spends a lot of money when they go to the dentist. And the choices that we make around dental care are pretty instructive, I think, for what we're likely to see with any of the genetic enhancements that we were talking about today. Mm-hmm. I think that we should expect exactly what you said, that in the world where it's better to be tall, more tall people will change what it means to be tall, and those who can afford to do more will have more. I don't think, though, I really don't, that world is going to feel engineered. I think it will feel just like the world we're in now. It's just that we don't notice it now. If you ask someone who, you know, died 20 years ago, who spent the bulk of their, if you ask someone who lived mostly in the early 20th century to evaluate our parenting with our kids, the things they learn, the things they do, you know, there isn't a Toys R Us anymore, right? I was asking someone yesterday, where do kids get toys? And the answer was, well, they don't. They're just buying apps. That's mind-blowing to me, right? I think we are unrecognizably enhanced from the perspective of someone who lived out their adult life in the early 20th century. And if you go to the 18th century, then we're aliens. When others look back at us, they're going to see the degree to which we allowed those who were super wealthy to enhance their children, and the fairy tales that we tell ourselves about what could happen in the future and how it's all high tech will appear to have been fairy tales, because to the generation of kids like mine, when they're having kids in a few years, they're going to look around them and see a forest of choices that weren't available to my parents or my parents' parents.
Right. JD, you seem to be trying to make this point in your book without overtly coming out and stating it, sort of making the subtle point through your fiction that we need to be paying attention to this issue.
Yeah. I didn't want the book to be, it's a thriller for God's sake, right? So yeah. I didn't want it to be didactic in any way. So I kind of basically left it to each reader to decide for himself or herself whether, you know, where do you draw the moral lines here, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, I just told the stories of all these characters and wanted folks to sort of decide whether or not they could relate to whether or not you would make the same kind of moral choices that they make. One kind of fun aside, though, is you brought up George Church. I think a lot of your listeners might not even know that he's the most interesting experiment he's doing today is he's basically trying to bring back the woolly mammoth. So he's doing all these experiments. They actually found the remains of the woolly mammoth, which went extinct during the last ice age, and he's cloning them and trying to breed them inside a modern African elephant. And we're going to see what's going to come out of these experiments. He's at step one of this experiment. But, you know, who knows? Maybe we're not that far away from Jurassic Park someday.
Right. Hey, before we move on to the more sort of graveyard portion of our show, while we're still talking about babies, you mentioned, JD, these developments in babies with three biological parents. And I think it's worth looking at that really quickly before we move on. Again, it's a fascinating subject that you could spend a whole show on, but it seems to be the first slippery slope of manipulating an embryo's DNA to accomplish some goals. Originally, as these procedures first started to be carried out, it was to do away with defects that were lurking in the mitochondrial DNA of the egg. And they were replacing that mitochondrial DNA with good mitochondrial DNA that would allow the egg, as I understand it, the mitochondrial DNA is quite crucial to allowing the egg to develop and thrive and gestate and become a baby. So you need healthy mitochondrial DNA, and the original experiments in this were guaranteeing that that would happen. But now what's happened in the Ukraine is a clinic there has decided, hey, there are plenty of people out there who want to have their own biological children and can't for whatever reason. Their eggs are not going to do it for them. So what we're going to do is take a donor egg the way that you would if you were doing a surrogacy with a set of other sperm from somewhere. We'll take a donor egg and we'll take out everything but the mitochondrial DNA, which is healthy mitochondrial DNA in these eggs. And we're going to replace it with the would-be biological mother's DNA. And that way, this couple, and I guess you, I need to ask Glenn more details about this. I'm thinking there are probably ways in which this could be used by same-sex couples as well. Maybe, I don't know. But the target demographic here are mothers who otherwise couldn't use their own egg to achieve a pregnancy. Now they can through this clinic in the Ukraine. And what you wind up with is a child who has three biological parents, because there's the residual mitochondrial DNA and then the imported DNA from the would-be mother and the sperm from the father. So when you read through, there's a fascinating piece at NPR about the clinic doing this. They are unapologetic. They say, the doctor says, you know, there are plenty of desperate people out there who want to have their own biological children, and we want to help them. So Glenn, discuss.
Really? Yeah. Well, this is, as you said, I mean, this is not the first time that someone has used the DNA of multiple people. That experiment has various versions of breaking up the egg into different parts for the purpose of allowing a potential parent to overcome some, you know, limitation that would prevent them from having a healthy pregnancy, a successful pregnancy, have existed. And this is another instance of three-parent baby, but that term has been used for several other procedures as well. Those who work in the industry usually prefer to use the reproductive technology industry, prefer to use a different way of talking about it. They sometimes call it nuclear transfer to talk about just moving the DNA at the nucleus from one to another. Mm-hmm. But essentially, for me, it's helpful to just think about this as breaking all the components of an embryo into parts. So you've got, you know, the sperm has some components to it. It's been discussed in principle and attempted in animals to break the DNA of the sperm into or the parts of a sperm into components so that you could have a man who had sperm that weren't motile get the hull, I guess, of the sperm from a different person and then put the DNA into the sperm. That's never actually happened in a human. Probably won't, for a variety of reasons that andrologists, those who study sperm, could tell us about. On the egg side, there's the egg shell, as it were. There's the goop inside, and the goop contains mitochondrial DNA, which, as you said, is essential for pregnancy. It's also essential for the metabolism of cells generally. And women who have mitochondrial DNA problems, those problems almost always result in something significant, a real risk or a definite illness for the resulting fetus and typically no birth. And then, of course, there's the DNA we think of. And all these parts together, the kind of salad that ends up making an embryo, they can all be combined, recombined, and we can reasonably expect that there'll be lots of different versions in our lifetime of multi-parent children. But why do we do this? I guess I find myself saying. I've debated this and written about it a lot. And what I find is what you discussed, that is that this is an enormously expensive process. There are, as the clinic said, lots of desperate people who are happy to participate in it. But in the end, it's not so much the fact that there's an additional person who could be described as a parent or a partial parent that worries mm-hmm. me. There are plenty of kids right now who have multiple parents for a variety of different reasons. I don't think that's that strange. What is unusual about it, I think, is that it costs so much money. And when you ask parents why do they do it, the answers that they give, I think, are sort of redolent of a way of thinking about reproduction that is at its base scary. When I think about the future of reproductive technology being worrisome, I maybe it sounds strange, but I think that the obsession with having our DNA in our offspring and those that we care for is going to seem more and more like an obsession as the process of having children becomes more and more a technical process, right? So,
Yeah.
Also, it's a risky technology. One piece that I think you mentioned, but is important right. to repeat, is that it has been successful in a few cases, just as Jamie Griffo's technology in the U.S. for nuclear transplant has been successful, and it's been successful in Europe. But it's risky.
Yeah. I think that I forget where I read that it was in one of these stories. Maybe it was the clinic in the Ukraine has tried it 14 times or has tried it 21 times. 14 did not work, but 7 did. So that's a fairly high failure rate. JD, how is this the slippery slope that may lead to the future Birthrights Unlimited offering its services?
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, these are, you know, we could say they're kind of obsessive compulsive kinds of desires by the public, but you know, this is like the basic stuff that you know, parents want. You want your own kid. Yes, you will go to an adoption agency if you need to, but choice number one is always to see if you could have your own biological child. And as the technology becomes more advanced, as those bioinformatics, artificial intelligence, quantum computer capabilities get more advanced, we're going to start seeing more and more of these kinds of offerings in the marketplace. And I think a lot of it is going to be done below the surface. So we're not going to even know, again, you know, when the first human clone is created or when some of these kinds of, I mean, in the book, if you remember in an early chapter, Waterhouse was talking about the fact that he didn't want to take his company public because of all the different SEC requirements, mm-hmm. all the different kinds of Wall Street regulatory filings that he'd have to make. If you do a lot of this stuff as a private company, you can get away with a lot of crap, believe me. So if you, in fact, if you do a lot of stuff under the table and make it a sort of premium off-the-shelf kind of thing that you're only offering to a select clientele, then it becomes a little bit more nefarious. But you know, there's going to be a marketplace for this. And so, so to answer your question, for us as a society, we have to start just debating where we are and where that line should be drawn, and whether or not it's with any kind of use of this technology, or is it just for to cure diseases, genetic diseases, or if you do that, then it becomes a little bit difficult, as people like Glenn and others have pointed out, of defining exactly what a malady or a disability is. You know, do you consider asthma something like that, or how serious does it have to be before you remedy it? And then so that, you know, yeah, it is a slippery slope, but people are going to want to do this. You know, the mm-hmm. example in Ukraine, that's outlawed in the U.S. And mm-hmm. as this becomes more and more commonplace and people start seeing, well, why is this allowed over there, but you have to fly off to Ukraine or to Mexico or to some other place to have this procedure, there might be some push to make it legal in the U.S. And then we have to start coming up with some rules of the road for what's allowed and what's not allowed. So I'm not smart enough to know exactly where that fuzzy line should be drawn, but it's a conversation we should start having as a public and not just leave it to the professionals and to the scientists.
Right. Well, if we don't move on from the life side of things to the death side of things here, we're never going to finish this show. There's so much to talk about, so much we haven't even reached, including the fate of pre-embryos that are generated in the IVF process. There's at least one wrongful death suit pending as to pre-embryos that were allowed to warm up. There was power failure. There have been, I think, numerous power failures at different storage facilities for these things. So things to think about there. All kinds of other things to think about. Oh, there's a very fascinating law that was enacted in Arizona that and this touches on, this touches on a theme in JD's book as well. What can be done? You talked about the family law context, making some of this law possible or bringing it to us, Glenn. And I think this is a good example of that. It was a debate about what happens to the embryos. And there have been, I think, several lawsuits about this over the years when a family has gone through IVF and then divorces and has embryos in storage. And one parent wants to go forward with a pregnancy and with one of those embryos and one does not. Arizona now has a law that says that the half of the couple that has the greatest chance or the desire to bring the embryos to life gets them. And if they both want to, then it becomes sort of a custody battle for the family courts to iron out. But this whole notion that do you have a right to say no, I don't want to become a biological parent of another child. Arizona has basically said no. The person who wants those embryos to come to life gets the opportunity to do so. So there's so much to unpack there. Matt, I wanted to ask you if you have any final questions or thoughts before we move on to the death portion of our show today.
Yeah, just a, really interesting dynamic that what, you know, sort of our fear is that we're going to have ubiquitous, you know, in similar looking people who are all tall and blonde and blue eyed. But in reality, what people are spending money on is having people who are of their own heritage. And so just kind of like playing out that dynamic that, you know, you have this woman who's going through this very expensive procedure to have someone who looks like her. You have people who are spending money on dogs that look exactly like their own dogs. And so like, it just shows that we don't, you know, the rational decision, if you wanted a perfect child, would to be to buy at that sperm bank that has all the smart people and all the tall people and all the athletic people. That's not like, you know, people spend millions and millions of dollars to be able to have their own children when it's difficult for them. So it's just a really interesting, like, human reaction that seems to be across the globe that we just want to have you know, people who are like us, which is not rational.
No, it's not, but it's real.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Let us move on to talking about the death end of things. This is a woman I encountered in the Apple store who, proclaims herself via t-shirt to be a product of genetic engineering. So one of the points that I wanted to ask you guys about, what you thought about, one of our listeners recommended that I watch the series Altered Carbon on Netflix, and I'm glad they did because it has, you know, several bioethical issues that it raises in its dystopian future world. The primary one has to do with prolonging life. And it's a constant theme through that show that technology will develop ways in which we can prolong life in that case virtually indefinitely because the singularity also happened. So you could just keep uploading your intellect into a new sleeve, as they called the cloned bodies in that work of fiction. But there's this overarching theme of, should we be prolonging human life beyond a certain point? Is there a point at which it becomes dangerous to society or just wrong? And I'm wondering from a bioethicist standpoint, Glenn, what you think about that notion?
Well, I'll be honest. I think the folks who work in either the so-called transhumanists who work on a wide variety, among whom are many super respectable scientists and philosophers and clinicians. I think they're working on something that's very interesting and important, because every time has had those who've sort of asked, well, should we live longer? What would happen if we live longer? Could we live longer, et cetera? And I think if you look at the sort of human species at this time, we've done so much to systematically limit our lifespans that even though from a public health perspective, you know, we seem to be living longer and longer lives, so many of us in society don't live very long at all. And in, you know, most of the world outside the United States and other developed countries, people have a pretty awful life in spite of the progress we've made. And all that just to say, I actually think it's maybe quaint's the wrong word, but it's definitely not super dangerous that we've got folks who are focused on increasing the lifespan of a human being. And, you know, they may very well be the researchers who actually find some of the most important keys to solving some of the most important diseases. If it worked, though, right? Because that's the question I think you're really asking. If it really worked and we could live 100 years longer than we live now or some other appreciable amount of time, who wouldn't want that?
Right.
I think it's a good question.
You'd have to pay attention to the quality of life as well, right? I mean, the science fiction world of altered carbon posits that mentally people get bored and violent, that their experiences become old and tired, and they're jaded, and they seek new experiences that they should not. So, I mean, you could speculate about that, but even putting those sorts of concerns aside, if we could, we can and are prolonging lives. People are, you know, living longer. Maybe, as you say, more people could be living longer, and we should work toward that. But there are certainly people who are living to the point where that we've eliminated certain diseases, but their quality of life may not be fantastic or even good. They, you know, the body just degenerates even if you've eliminated various diseases. And is that okay? You know, are we making people live out lives in wheelchairs, and is that a problem at all?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I wonder myself, because I think there are so many ways in which we can look forward and see that somebody's going to figure out how to lengthen our telomeres, somebody's going to figure out how to accomplish a gene repair in a fundamental way. There are companies all around the world that are doing stem cell work in various ways that believe that they have figured out a way to harness the power of stem cells to keep us alive a little longer. Maybe these things are going to work. Maybe they will improve the livelihoods of those who are now healthy or who have disabilities and want to get to a better sleeve, as Altered Carbon puts it, you know, and maybe we'll all just, you know, I mean, we live the lives we live now wondering when we're going to die. Much of what it is about mortality for us now is a complete mystery, so that people are surprised at an early age by cancer or whatever, you know, all kinds of things can happen. Who knows what age you'll be when you die. I think the notion that we could get bored, that, you know, a longer life could actually be a tedious one, the kind of vampire idea that, you know, really eventually you're just going to want to shuffle off that sleeve and go to another world. Maybe it's true, but we are so far from knowing.
Yeah.
And right now, I guess I personally, maybe it's because I'm 50. You know, if you'd asked me this question 10 years ago, I probably would have been a little more skeptical or suspicious about the fact that we're spending even $1 on these lengthy life projects. But honestly, most of the money going into this stuff right now is from bored Silicon Valley billionaires who have set up islands off the coast of California, like Peter Thiel, you know, to study this, that, and the other thing about how we'll live longer. It's so much money from the Googles and the PayPals and so on is going into how to, you know, bring these millennial and just pre-millennial electronic folks into, you know, 200-year lifespans. And I think they'll probably find something. And I'm happy because it's not my tax dollars at work.
No, but it's all of our tax dollars that are, you know, supporting people who are living longer too, and as they should be. But it's just something we have to think about as a society.
I would just add one thing. Let me add one thing as when I turn 100 or 200, and if I could come back into Joel Kinnaman's body, I definitely would do it. I don't know if anybody's watched Altered Carbon on the chat here, but it's one of the most fun shows, and I think it's got one of the best actors on TV. He's also the guy who starred in The Killing, so it's just it's a pleasure to watch on that level alone.
Yes, it raises all kinds of interesting questions. One a bit far afield for our show today, but maybe for another show. Can you murder an AI? Think about that one. All right. So speaking of murder and death, a big theme in JD's book, as he already mentioned, is how you gather together a bunch of DNA that you could put to other useful and marketable purposes. And one way that is pursued in your book, JD, is to go retrieve it from places where DNA has been left in the ground or in a tomb. Yeah, tell us about the legal research you did on that and what you learned.
Well, I relied on experts like you, Denise, to sort of steer me in the right direction. I was sort of coming at it cold, trying to figure out, okay, you know, there are a lot of different categories here. You've got living, you know, like Hollywood celebrities who are leaving their DNA behind in different places. Can you legally take advantage of that? There are the recently deceased. So people, celebrities, even like Marilyn Monroe or Frank Sinatra, they've actually got talent agencies that survive long after their deaths, and they're still licensing their likenesses today, but they are not likely to license their DNA. And then you have the long dead legends like Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo, people who have been interred hundreds of years ago. And there's actually an interesting kind of legal question for the lawyers out there of, you know, who owns the remains of Leonardo da Vinci today? Is it the Church of the church where he's buried? Is it his ancestors 450 years removed? Somebody else, you know? So the question is, what happens, you know, besides from the criminal point of view, if you send a team of grave robbers, and I've got my grave team operator shirt on here. if you send a grave team operators out there to dig up Leonardo's body, after the criminal statute of limitations passes, and the only question is whether you have the legal right to clone Leonardo's remains and clone it for a particular set of a variety of different traits, whether you'd be allowed to do that or not. And I think it's actually kind of an open question of you know, who's going to stop you from doing that, the state or somebody? Who's going to have actually standing to stop you from cloning Leonardo? So I don't know. Probably some attorney out there listening to this would have a better idea than I. But from a fictitious point of view, it's just kind of interesting to go out there and decide you want to dig up the remains of the most famous legends in history and then let the chips fall where they may after that.
Right. One of the fascinating parts about your exploration of those issues to me was the fact that, you know, laws that we have around grave robbing never anticipated these kinds of concerns. the exactly. Penalties, there could be penalties for removing someone's remains, stealing someone's remains, and generally they are, but they're not very severe. And they're not looking toward this kind of situation. What were you going to say, Glenn?
Oh, I just think it's fascinating as well. I think the idea that, you know, we are contained in our DNA is one that, you know, for a while seemed kind of silly and fanciful to people in genetics, because of course, you know, we've always made this distinction between, you know, the erector set we're made out of and then what we do with it. But the truth is that so much of what happens to us becomes a part of our DNA. So we have all the DNA we inherited, and then we go through our lives and the, you know, the moles and age spans spots and, you know, all these things that, that again, at 50, I'm ever more aware of the traumas we encounter. You know, they're very real and measurable, and they also imprint in our cells. So the DNA of a person, I mean, I don't believe for a minute that someone who goes and takes the DNA from a crypt is going to get a copy of that person in a total or real sense. But I am more and more convinced that the thing they get would be scary and might very well be the sort of thing that the dead person would have had an interest in preventing. And, you know, our law is pretty bad when it comes to dealing with dead people because, of course, you know, dead people can't have rights and you got property-based law, a constitution that really definitely did not envision dead people having interests. So, you know, we just don't have the sort of legal spectacles to think about those interests of the, you know, person who's been dead 5 minutes or 500 years. And so we're not going to do a very good job of it. And I think JD is pointing us in the right direction. We have to be more mindful, frankly, of what it is that we could reasonably foresee in the future that we wouldn't want to have happen to us. I mean, you know, honestly, our whole lives are about that now, right? We, you know, every time you pick up your smartphone, it's asking you to give permission. And you know, the recent years and recent events have focused so much attention on how many bits of permission we're giving and how all-encompassing they are, so that we leave artifacts all over the internet, all over society and our friends and our lives, data about us we don't even begin to understand. Once you sort of collect all that data, the data that is the footprint of our lives, piece it together, add it to the DNA that you've got, you know, that you've left behind in the crypt, how far really are we from constructing a biological facsimile of a person who's actually alive now? Maybe 200 years, 300 years, I don't know, or maybe it could happen in the next 100.
If you're looking for an example of a current grappling with what can be done with the DNA from ancient remains, well, we know, and we have in our discussion points from today, we've already discussed trying to bring back the woolly mammoth. Others are trying to bring back the dodo. Some archaeologists just want to study the DNA of people who lived hundreds of years ago. And there's a controversy or at least a discussion about whether a tiny mummified body that was found in Chile, whether there were any restrictions to studying its DNA. And the journal Genome Research, which published an analysis of that DNA, decided that the mummy was merely a specimen, did not require special ethical consideration, did not legally qualify as a human subject because she is not living. So if, you know, we're going to take into account that there might be things that could be done with DNA other than simply studying how people lived hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, we might want to rethink how we regulate and enact laws about that. The other thing that we've mentioned, the other way you can abandon DNA is not merely by dying, but by going to a restaurant and drinking a glass of water and wondering whether your cleanup team is going to prevent someone from taking that glass. I think it's kind of charming that there's a piece in Bon Appetit magazine discussing the murky legal world of the DNA you leave behind in restaurants, et cetera. We know that abandoned DNA is out there in the world everywhere, and we know that it's being used. We now know specifically, and we talked about this a few weeks ago on the show, that part of the way that they caught the Golden State Killer and various other serial killers throughout the years, but specifically we now have prosecutorial confirmation from the Golden State Killer case that abandoned tissues were used to collect DNA that the investigators needed to tie together all the loose ends in those cases. So this whole notion of the DNA that we leave around us is going to become more and more important, and we're going to need to think about, you know, if you're out in public leaving things, is it like being in public for the purposes of a photograph? We have special laws that protect celebrities in that kind of case, right, of publicity laws that have come in and sort of trumped this overarching privacy framework that we have that says, hey, if you're in public, you're fair game. I would think that we would see a similar kind of legal process develop as we go forward into these brave new worlds of DNA usages, where right of publicity laws don't only protect celebrities, they protect you from being exploited for commercial purposes without your permission. And I would think that abandoned DNA laws might start to look the same way. But right now we have nothing, as far as I understand it. Glenn, is that your understanding as well?
Well, we have mostly nothing. What we have are mm-hmm. a bunch of cases where the courts have tried to figure out how to treat genetic material, and more importantly, for the purposes of something like the Golden State Killer, to figure out whether or not there's entrapment involved, whether the materials were legally obtained. I think in that case, they induced someone to spit in a tube, and I don't remember the whole story, but honestly, the question about how you come to leave your DNA is one that is a part of a mess of bioethics mm-hmm. stuff around genes. We for a long time allowed companies to patent DNA that they discovered. So mm-hmm. BRCA1, breast cancer gene, was owned by Myriad Genetics for years until the Supreme Court flipped that one. Many have heard the story of Henrietta Lacks. So this is a movie was made by Oprah, no less, after a book by Rebecca. And frankly, that story took the opposite position, that it was the DNA of a particular person who left some genetic material behind at Johns Hopkins that was responsible for the discovery. And so it should be credited there, at least according to the position that was taken in the book. People are all over the place. ACLU doesn't know where it stands. You know, if you ask any given attorney, the position they take on genetic material is going to generally be determined by what they're arguing for at any given particular moment. There isn't really a constituency on this. And so, we all sort of feel like that we should own or at least be able to control most of the stuff we leave behind to some degree, if you ask it that way. But if it's flipped so that, you know, the stuff that you leave behind could actually implicate you in hurting people in some way, like secondhand smoke does, then everybody wants to disavow their DNA. So we're going to have to create an entirely new way of thinking about this stuff that comes off of and out of our bodies within the next 5 to 10 years for a variety of reasons. I don't think one of the main ones is cloning people. But I do think definitely that the privacy implications of the fact that you can now just take a scientific vacuum cleaner and figure out who did what where, they're massive.
Yes. Matt Curtis, I understand you need to go on and leave us. I want to thank you for joining us today on This Week in Law. It's been a fascinating discussion.
Oh, my gosh. This is wonderful. Thank you both for coming on. This is a good deep dive for me, and thanks for all your wisdom.
We'll go ahead and land the plane without you, but thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Watch where you leave that DNA too.
Yeah, please. Yes, we're definitely going to all have to worry about where we leave our DNA, and in fact, that's going to be our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. It will be tissue traps. Hopefully you're already good about throwing away your tissues, but once you've thrown them away, you've abandoned them, and you better think about what might be discernible from your leavings thereon. All right.
Does that mean there's going to be a market for like shredders for...
Oh, God. I mean, I think, yeah, I do think, Victor, I think you're onto something there, that there, you know, a way to sort of sanitize your trash of DNA is certainly something that people are going to be interested in. You know, it's not only Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump who are concerned about what might be done with their DNA, and increasingly more and more people will be. So entrepreneurial idea number one of the show.
I think Brooke's on it already.
Oh, good, good. Trash sanitization, however you can do it. Well, I guess we'll go right to our resources of the week first, because somebody has an entrepreneurial idea that goes right to the heart of that. We've actually featured this as a resource before when we did first discuss the Golden State Killer. And that is that several years ago, I think it was 2013 or 2014, there were some news stories about a company called Biogen Futures, They still have a website up. I have no idea if this product ever came to market or if there are copycat products out there somewhere. But the idea of the product is to deal with this abandoned DNA issue. They have two things. One is called Erase. The other is called Replace. And as a package, it's called Invisible. And what you would do is use both of their little sprays wherever you have been, restaurant or otherwise, that erases and replaces your DNA that you've left behind. And there is a big red buy now button on that website. I have no idea what happens when you click that button. But it is an idea whose marketable time may have come. So if that is not the product, then look for others like it. Of course, our other resources of the week are the book Biohack by J.D. Lassica. And do go over to birthrightsunlimited.com/twill and maybe be one of the 10 lucky listeners or viewers that gets a free copy of the book. And also next on my reading list is Glenn McGee's book, Bioethics for Beginners, which is his most current book that I think will very nicely carry on some of the concepts and discussions that we've had here on the show today. Can you tell us a bit more about what you cover in this book, Glenn?
Yeah, it's a bunch of cases. So I basically, much as we've been today, I go through pretty much all of the kind of core kinds of cases that happen in bioethics, from birth and death and genetic engineering and, you know, even the really weird stuff, making cryptocurrency out of your DNA and so on. And then I also talk about some of the sort of odd things that I've encountered personally. And it's a way of introducing bioethics. I'm actually always surprised at how many people say they want to work in bioethics. It's actually a very, very fast growing field. Every hospital has to have a bioethics committee now. And, you know, there are plenty of ways that bioethics can fit into other careers. We train people at the University of New Haven to work in healthcare administration, and almost everybody ends up needing to know something about ethics. This is sort of an introduction to all that.
Our tip of the week goes back to Mr. Church, who we discussed earlier, and is a product that he's bringing to market. Speaking of the blockchain, this MIT professor, early involved founder, I believe, of the Human Genome Project, George Church, has a startup called Nebula Genomics that is getting close. It's not quite ready to do it, but it's getting close to giving you a way. It has partnered up with a startup called Longenesis. And what the two of them intend to do is create a new blockchain-based marketplace that will market and sell genomic, clinical, and health record data. And before you get too creeped out by that, the whole notion of this is to put people in the driver's seat of what happens with their genomic data. The need that this is filling, as I understand it, is a concern that as people, you know, just give their data over to various DNA databases for analysis and then ultimate sale to others, rather than not being in the driver's seat of that process. If you do want to have your DNA analyzed, they intend to give you a means of doing that. And then should you want to sell it to anyone, you are in control of how that's done. So, our tip is that that is coming your way if that's something that seems interesting to you. What do you think of this, Glenn?
I think it's fascinating. And I wouldn't bet against George Church. The cryptocurrency possibilities for having something as complicated as DNA as the underneath it all are probably pretty persuasive. And he wants to make everybody's DNA into a coin, which I think is sort of clever and, you know, might work. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I don't know anyone who understands how this technology will be deployed, including George Church, really. So it's one of those deals that if you bet now, you might really make a lot of money, and it's definitely a technology to follow.
Right. How he plans to go about this is he's going to have an ICO. There will be a token sale. They're redeemable only for an individual's DNA data. And it's going to be called a Nebula token. So keep an eye out for that. Interesting idea. And then finally, our animal selfie of the week. We have already teased, but we will bring them back just for your viewing pleasure. I am bending the rules this week. This is not technically a selfie where the animals took the photo themselves, but we have Scarlet and Violet, the dogs, Barbara Streisand's dogs, visiting Samantha, not their mom's grave. Samantha, their twin sister, genetic progenitor, I guess, would be more accurate. I'm sure they have no idea why they're in that nice green area, but I'm sure they'd like to run around and sniff everything in sight. Scarlet and Violet, just one example of cloned pets that are out there in the world. Probably Barbara Streisand's episode of that is the first time anyone really has heard of that in a large scale way, but she is not alone. Other people are out there cloning their pets. So thank you so much, Glenn and JD, for helping us get around our heads around that concept and many others here on today's episode. I really, really appreciate it and enjoyed our discussion.
It was fun. Thanks.
Yeah, Glenn, thanks a lot.
Glenn, is there anything going on at your university that you would like to let people know about if they're interested in learning more about this, anything they can attend, anything at all you want to plug other than your books?
Well, is there always something going on in bioethics? The best way to follow it is, I'll say with a little bias here because I'm the founding editor of it, is the American Journal of Bioethics, and it's bioethics.net is mm-hmm. the URL for that journal, and it's pretty much a constant source of, I don't know, hilarious, scary information about what's going on in the world of healthcare and biotechnology.
Hilarious and scary. We like the combination. Thank you for sharing that. JD Lasica, your book is heavier on the scary than the hilarious, though it does have its humorous moments, to be sure. I really enjoyed it, and I'm so glad that you've been able to join us to discuss it and all of the issues around it today here on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Denise. It's been a lot of fun. These issues aren't going away anytime soon. Let's continue the conversation. I'm on Twitter all the time at JD Lasica, and I hope some of you do enter the giveaway for Biohack at birthrightsunlimited.com/twill.
Thank you so much, guys. This has just been a wonderful show. Thank you to our audience for joining us today. We record this show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. So if you enjoy playing along while we do the show live, we do have live chat where we can interact with our audience. And we've had great fun doing that today for sure. Please do try and do that. If you can, if you can't, don't worry about it. Head on over to Twill. Twill's website at twit.tv/twill, where our entire archive of shows resides, including the two that JD has been on before. We hope this is not JD's last occurrence on the show. You've got to keep working toward that five episode blazer, JD, for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I look in green, so we'll see.
We'll see. Or you could just go play in the Masters and win the thing, and then you'd have a very nice green blazer as well. We do encourage you to get in touch with us between the shows. I am Denise at twit.tv. I'm D Howell on Twitter. Either of those are great ways to get in touch with me. Let me know what other sci-fi series I should be watching and thinking about on Netflix, et cetera, et cetera. You guys always send us such great thoughts and resources and discussion after the shows. Please, please, please keep them coming. Suggestions of people to have on, other topics to explore. We love it. Keep sending them in. We really, really appreciate it. Could not do the show without all that great support and suggestions. So can't thank you enough. We are going to be taking a rather lengthy summer break coming up soon. We will do one more show next week. And then we're basically taking the entire month of July off. So we encourage you to also pursue your work-life balance in the summer and do things with your family, et cetera, et cetera, while we're taking a break from Twill. But we'll do one more show next week and then be off till August 3rd. So definitely join us next week. to say goodbye before our little hiatus. We hope that you can. If not, again, you know, our whole archive of shows is there for you to delve into at twit.tv/twill. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll see you next week here on This Week in Law. Take care.